Good morning, greetings. Yes, if you watch some of the media coverage last night too, you think we're the hottest thing in town. I'm particularly referring to Lateline Business, which actually had an extensive coverage of yesterday's conference. Well, this is day two with the overall theme of pioneering best practice, and our first session is about digging for value. And I'll talk about that a little more in a moment, but I just want to bring to your attention a few things you might need to know. Firstly, I might ask you again to remember mobile phones, to turn those off. At today's lunch, we're delighted to have Senator Nick Sherry, the Minister for Superannuation and Corporate Law, as our guest speaker. The Minister has been asked to speak about the global financial crisis and the remuneration review for directors and executives, which is certainly a hot topic. At the morning tea break, a video of the East Asian Actuarial Congress will be shown here on this screen. Countries attending were Hong Kong, India, Indonesia, Japan, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, and Australia. The next conference of the East Asian Actuarial Congress will be in Seoul from the 12th to the 15th of October this year. Evaluation forms, just a reminder that they're in your satchel, and it would help if you would just take a moment to perhaps progressively fill out those yellow forms as the program goes ahead and hand them to the registration desk before you leave. And just one last thing. Those departing Sydney tomorrow afternoon from the airport, we have a small bus leaving at 20 minutes to 3 going to the domestic and international airports. Now, you can check at the registration desk by lunchtime today if you wish to be on that bus. Well, to our two speakers now in our first session this morning, and we have Martijn Wilder looking at the logistics of response to climate change, and Bruce Rigby looking at financing demographic shifts, pension and healthcare scenarios to 2030. And I just did a quick calculation, and I realise I'll need both pension and healthcare help by 2030. First of all, Martijn, we're following the same format as yesterday. These are being webcast. We'll hear from each of the speakers and then have a general discussion. Martijn Wilder heads Baker & McKenzie's Global Climate Change. He's based in Sydney, but heads the Global Climate Change and Emissions Trading Practice, with over 50 lawyers from across the world participating in that, and is certainly regarded as one of the leading carbon lawyers in the world, having worked in the area for over 12 years. I don't know how much further back you need to go to have carbon lawyers, but I imagine 12 years is about the limit. Representing an international client base, he's advised a number of governments and clients on the development of climate change and emissions trading laws. Martijn's published widely in the climate change and international law area. His family came to Australia when they were young. He has a Dutch father and I think an English mother. The other way around. And the family has had a long involvement in publishing. So, Martijn, welcome.
Okay, thanks very much for the introduction. The focus, what I'm going to talk about today, is about what's happening in the Australian context with climate policy, but then towards the end I can touch a little bit more on what's happening globally. The reason that this is so relevant, I think, for the conference which we're at today is that while issues of climate change are an environmental issue, really managing them from a corporate perspective is really in the ambit of the CFO, the CEO, and working out the numbers and how much it's going to cost you to comply. So while historically, in our experience, has been an issue which I guess sustainability managers, et cetera, within corporations have looked at, in truth, it's really an issue which should be dealt with at the CEO, CFO issue. So it's particularly important, I think, in that context. Also, having a discussion a moment ago about how this ties into the next session, I think one of the important things about climate change is it will have real impacts on health and ageing populations going forward. So we might, in a question time, talk a little bit about the link between the two. But just in terms of Australia, it's difficult, if you're not in this area, to sort of contemplate just how significant the developments are at the moment. I've used the term juggernaut to describe it, but there is a significant legislative reform going on in Australia at the moment, which really is one of the most significant legislative reform packages, I think, in Australian history. There's a full suite of domestic legislation which has either come into force or is on the table to go before Parliament at the moment, which will not only put in place 7, 8, 9, 10 new laws, but it will also set up an entire new regulatory regime, and we'll have a regulator that that probably is larger than the ACCC. It'll cover a whole range of areas, from reporting on emissions to trading emissions to the approval of projects that have an emissions impact to the approval of new energy infrastructure to working out tax liabilities, particularly if you buy permits and surrender them when the tax liability crystallises, sinks. And already the ACCC has prosecuted a number of companies for making false claims in the carbon space. We also have a whole range of state legislation on climate change that exists, and this in itself is a particular issue, because trying to work out when certain state legislation falls away is something which is an issue of quite significant debate at the moment. And also, the Australian context has to be seen within what is a global market. The European Union have for many years now had emissions trading scheme in place. That scheme is continuing to be developed, and the US has now got draft cap and trade legislation before the House, which is being considered. So the US administration, perhaps more than anybody else, is actually driving this extremely hard at the moment, and in many ways the US will take over as the global, as the core of the global market, as opposed to the EU. From an Australian context, we had a sudden change in policy with the election of the Rudd government. On day two of the government coming into force, it ratified the Kyoto Protocol, which was, a reversal of the long-term Australian government policy to that date. And this was significant for two key reasons. One, because not only did it signify a sudden change of policy in Australia and the start of what was perhaps a new policy direction for Australia, but it also has created an expectation internationally that Australia will take some fairly significant steps in implementing climate change policy and in many ways take a leadership role. And the early statements by the Rudd government at the climate change conference in Bali in December the year before last were very much in that vein. So it's important just to quickly look where we've come from. As I said, in December 2007, we ratified Kyoto. In July 2008, comprehensive legislation requiring all Australian companies who emit greenhouse and use energy above a certain level have to report that energy use and emissions. And a lot of companies who we speak to still aren't quite aware that this legislation exists, even though the end of the first compliance period is July this year, and even though a CEO can be personally liable for not properly or negligently dealing with reporting. I'll come back to that in a moment. In July last year, we had the government released a green paper, which was a pretty comprehensive document saying, this is our overall perspective on how we think the emissions trading scheme should be designed. On this particular issue, we have a number of policy positions and we're interested in getting your feedback. There was extensive consultation that resulted in December, the publication of a white paper, which was a much more detailed proposal for the emissions trading scheme, which narrowed down many of the options in the green paper. And since then, we've had a number of discussion papers on various topics come out. For example, how do you deal with trade-exposed industries? How do you deal with landfills, etc.? Also, specifically on carbon sinks in Australia. And then on the 10th of March, as most of you probably know, we had draft legislation came out. And that legislation is very comprehensive, and the government's planning to get that to the House to the House of Reps in the next few months. So things are moving fairly quickly. Just in terms of right now, as I said, we have in place a national greenhouse and energy reporting obligation. Under that obligation, you have to report Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions and energy use. And so this is particularly important because it's really a precursor to the emissions trading scheme. So to give you a simple example of a threshold, many of you probably know the Hilton Hotel in Sydney. Prior to that being refurbed, it had an energy use which was slightly above the threshold. Having been refurbed, its energy use is now now below the threshold, only very slightly. So when you think of this legislation in terms of businesses and factories, etc., it's anybody who uses energy use above a certain threshold is going to be caught and has to report. There is basically, as I said, a national framework and legislation in place. It's already started. The first reporting obligations, the first compliance period ends June 30th, 2009, with reports due in October. And it's a very difficult thing to do. To say to a company, you have to suddenly report to the government on all of your energy use above a certain threshold. And in some cases, there are very complex questions around if you have a joint venture or if you have contractors. If somebody comes onto your site and does an activity, you may be liable for that activity. It's a very big and significant task to ask companies to actually report on this, particularly when under the legislation, the requirements are that the reporting needs to be, you know, close to 95% accurate. So for a lot of companies, this has been a great challenge, and it's also very expensive. It's an expensive exercise to go through and work this out if you haven't historically done it. And as I said, CEOs themselves are subject to a civil penalty. The other interesting thing about the Act is that although the threshold for individual facilities are 25 kilotons, you can see on the screen there, for a corporation, if you have a group of facilities, which means as a corporation you breach these thresholds, then you have to report. And the government's made a conscious decision to start high, but over the next couple of years, from a corporate level, to reduce those thresholds significantly, as you can see on the screen there. As I said, what you have to report is fuel used and produced at the facility and energy used and produced at the facility, both Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, which are on the screen. And who has to report is also an interesting issue, but it's basically the top corporate in Australia. So it's not foreign companies, it's the top corporate in Australia who controls a corporate group. And the interesting thing is you have to have operational control. Now, what's as I said a moment ago, a challenge here is working out what the definition under the Act of operational control is, and it's really if you have authority to implement operating policies and environmental policies and health and safety policies. And that's not always very clear. If you're a business that has a whole a significant number of franchises across the country and you implement certain policies and control over those facilities, but they have some control themselves, it's working out whether or not you're liable to report them. You know, and if you, for example, in some cases we've looked at, we've had people who have had, you know, 3,000 contracts with transport and logistic companies, they control what those companies do, and so all of a sudden they have an obligation to go and review 3,000 contractual arrangements to work out what the energy use and the emissions are in order to report those. So this legislation is not only complex, but it's also fairly expensive in terms of working out, you know, and time-consuming in terms of working out reporting. And one company we dealt with recently really said this is like GST implementation. Getting your NGERS implementation in place at the outset. They've budgeted $7 million to do it, and it's pretty much for them. They've just taken sort of what they did on GST and rolled it out for greenhouse reporting. So as I said before, that reporting scheme is really in part designed to help the government put in place its carbon pollution reduction scheme. For the government to know, you know, who they're going to place an obligation to buy permits on under the law, they need to know how much you emit. So that's really where the NGERS legislation comes in. But the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme is Australia's attempt to put in place our emissions trading scheme. And again, if you don't do this on a sort of, I guess, a day-to-day basis, one of the things that you probably pick up from the press is that Australia, you know, is forging ahead with this and that it's sort of groundbreaking. But the reality is we really are one of the last industrialised countries to look at emissions trading. Nearly all of the European countries under the EU ETS are caught already. As I said, a lot of other countries are also doing this, like the US at the moment. And even South Korea and China are looking at emissions trading schemes. So in terms of our own legislation, we have the government's already put out the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme Bill. It's got amendments to the Corporations Act, amendments to the tax legislation, amendments to the Greenhouse Reporting Act. And the government's view has really been, rather than trying to have a single piece of legislation that, in effect, tries to do everything, we'll put one key piece of legislation that deals with the primary subject matter, and then we will tweak the other bits of legislation, like the corporations law, particularly with respect to financial services licences. If you're trading carbon and it becomes a derivative product, you'll need a licence. So it's trying to draw on existing legislation to complement what it's proposing. As I said before, it's also putting in place a significantly new regulatory authority, the Australian Climate Change Regulatory Authority, which will bring together a number of other existing regulatory authorities, the one that regulates NGERS, the one that regulates the mandatory reporting legislation, the renewable energy legislation, and then the emissions trading legislation. And it also deals with specific separate legislation dealing with the price caps under the legislation for constitutional reasons to make sure they weren't called a tax. So what it really does is the draft legislation which is out now takes the government's white paper and the key positions and really puts them into law. And there's not a significant deviation. The government's also flagged a number of areas where a lot more detail will come later. So, for example, under the emissions trading scheme, the only area you can generate an offset is in the forestry area, and they'll do a lot more detail on that later on. And there's a lot of debate at the moment about the extent to which emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries will be given compensation underneath the scheme by way of free permits. And there's a lot of discussion. The government has set up a separate committee to look at that in more detail. So from an in-house sort of CFO actuarial point of view, it's very important that you're across the numbers and the financial implications of the CPRS and working out whether there is a direct liability. This legislation is incredibly detailed and complex, and there are a lot of questions that you have to ask. So what I want to do is just walk through today some of the questions that you might need to think of as you deal with this going forward. In some cases, as a business, you may find you have no direct liability under emissions trading scheme. It's not directly relevant to you, but because of the costs imposed on those who are liable and the fact that those businesses will seek to pass those costs through, it will have a direct financial implication. And so there are a whole series of threshold issues that need to be worked through. So just to give you, at the start, a very high-level idea of what the scheme does, the scheme puts in place very long-term targets, and the reason they're long-term is to allow investors to see what the targets are going to be well into the future. One of the problems with the European scheme is that it was only a short-term 5-year phases, and therefore it was very hard. If I'm building a power station, I need to plan for 20 years what the carbon cost trajectories are going to be in the long term. And the idea is that in the longer term, Australia wants to reduce its emissions of 60% below 2000 levels by 2050. The target range the government's proposing at the moment is 5 to 15%, which is interesting because at Bali they were talking about a 25% reduction. So it is that they've moved slightly backwards on that, but there's the ability to ramp that up fairly quickly. If you emit more than 25,000 tonnes of carbon dioxide in a year, then you'll have to buy a permit for every tonne you emit, although you may be given some permits for free. And the government's clear preference, and we'll come to this later on, is that the scheme starts on 1 July 2010. If the government gets its way, on the screen there is the compliance timeframe, and you'll basically have to buy permits on an annual basis and surrender them. And again, this timeframe is partly dependent on the legislation getting through the House. As I said before, the scheme itself does in fact recognise that certain Australian industries will be heavily affected, and it does put in place a whole series of compensation packages for those industries that are emissions intensive and trade exposed. So if you produce a product in Australia and you shipped it overseas and you had to compete with a product that didn't have a carbon impost, the government's trying to realign that impost. The government's also said, which is very unique to Australia, that in the early years we're going to put a price cap on carbon in the scheme. So we're going to start it at $40 in the first year, and then it will increase by CPI and an amount each year. So the idea is that the $40 amount will soon go to $45, then $50, and so forth, and then eventually it will be phased out when it's reasonably required to do so. This is particularly relevant because while it puts a cap on the cost for industry, it sort of inhibits our ability to trade with other schemes because other schemes that don't have a price cap. But we'll come to that in a moment. Also, there's a lot of Australian large industrial and mining houses now who are entering into contracts with the so-called boutique forestry providers, people who are planting trees with a view that they can buy those permits off them, and so for the long term they can use those permits for compliance reasons. And there's also an ability to go into the international market and buy what are called certified emission reductions, which are specific credits developed under the Kyoto Protocol, and bring those into Australia for compliance purposes. Now, the reason you do that as an Australian business is if you're looking at an Australian permit and that's $38 or $30, and you're looking at an international CDM permit, and that is, at the moment, it's trading at about €9. If you can get it at a much more significant cost, there's obviously a big difference. So if you had to buy 1 million permits in Australia and you could buy them at, say, $15 on the international market as opposed to paying $25 or $30 on the Australian market, then there's an incentive to buy internationally. And the government has said you can buy as many as you like internationally. As I said before, the government will set up a regulator. The regulator will be able to do spot checks, and it's going to be those spot checks will be modelled on the tax system. It'll have a range of powers in terms of investigating and enforcing our company's compliance with the scheme. And if there's a shortfall, then you'll have to basically make that up in the following years, as well as have a penalty as well. And also executive officers of companies may be liable. So I think that's a very important point when you have legislation that comes in which actually targets CEOs themselves about in terms of their liability. So sitting in your position with all this legislation that's coming through, the sort of key questions you've got to ask yourself is am I actually liable under all this legislation? Is it at all relevant, or is my liability largely a result of the cost being passed through? Can I transfer that liability within the company? And in some cases, the legislation allows you to do that. It is possible on certain occasions to do that. And also, within the petroleum sector, it's possible for certain companies downstream from those of the obligation to take that on, which I'll come back to. If I'm a company, do I have to... will I get any free permits from the government? And a lot of the lobbying at the moment is about companies getting free permits. And I think if you take somebody like Woodside, they were originally... I think given a small number of free permits, they lobbied very, very heavily, and I think now have about 60% of their permits for free, and they're still lobbying and asking for 90%. So different industries will get some compensation. And so you've got to work out whether or not you qualify as an emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries because they get the most compensation. Yet at the moment, there's still a significant debate going on as to ultimately what will qualify as that industry. The government intends to auction the permits, so you have to go into a government auction process to buy the permits. And again, as a business, there'll be consecutive auctions throughout the year, and you've got to decide which auction do I go to. Am I going to go to the very first auction, where I really don't know what the market's behaviour will be, whether or not people will bid high, or do I wait until a little bit further in the scheme? A key issue is cash flow. If I have a liability of 5 million permits, and they're $20 each, that's $100 million a year to buy permits. Staggering when I buy those permits, working out cash flow is a significant issue, and it's an issue which business is at the moment in discussions with government on, and they're saying we'd like the government to actually give us some relief and help us work through the cash flow implications of this. If I am imposed with a cost, there's the ability to pass it on to somebody else. So if you, for example, if you're, for example, someone like Caltex, you'll get an obligation, you'll add it to the petrol cost. And so, again, that depends on your contractual ability to do so. If you have higher electricity costs, will those simply be passed on as well? And, again, that's a contractual issue. And as I said before, in some parts of legislation, you can actually decide to take on a liability. So if you were, for example, a large fuel user and you were buying fuel from somebody upstream like a Caltex or a Shell or a BP, and they pass fuel on to you and they said, well, the fuel cost is X cents per litre and the carbon cost is Y cents per litre. If that Y cost was, say, for example, $20, and you as a business felt you could generate or get carbon offsets at $10, you may very well decide to take on that liability and surrender permits yourself because you can think you can do it at a much lower cost. So for some companies, there'll be a much greater incentive to get instrumentally involved in dealing with this as much more than a compliance issue. For others, they'll just simply buy permits and surrender them. So some of the other questions as well are, if I am looking at my liability, should I be purchasing domestic forestry offsets? And as I said, there's already a domestic market in Australia to buy forestry offsets because they are a compliance instrument under the New South Wales trading scheme and are mandated to be so under the federal scheme. Also, what is the price of carbon? I mean, should I be buying carbon right now on the international market? So if the early trades in Australia have been at $20-$25 Australian, the current international price for project-based carbon is around 8 or 9 euro, which is significantly less. So if you can pick up international carbon today, it's say, if you convert that euro price about, say, roughly 16, 18 Australian dollars, if you can save yourself $2 a tonne and you've got to buy, you know, a million tonnes, you know, you're actually saving yourself a lot of cash. So, you know, it's important to understand those dynamics if you have a large permit liability. If you have operations yourself offshore, can those offshore operations generate emission reductions? And a lot of Australian companies, people like Pacific Hydro, for example, have offshore energy facilities which do generate international carbon, which they're selling. There's a whole range of issues around managing the penalty and around the tax outcomes. You only get a tax deduction for a permit when you surrender it, so actually managing those tax deductions are important. And if I invest in certain forestry sink activities, I'm entitled to a tax deduction as well. So there's a whole lot of issues which I'm sure a lot of the participants in the conference, like the firms on the sponsors here, have been dealing with quite a lot. And finally, if I'm dealing with a new project, you know, how is that impacted upon, and how is the cost of that built into it? The government's policy coming to the last election was they would amend the federal government's environment protection biodiversity conservation legislation, which is a piece of legislation which says any project of Commonwealth significance or which has a Commonwealth impact has to have Commonwealth government approval. And we're still waiting to see whether or not the government's going to legislate to say any new project which emits above a certain level of emissions has to get additional approval from the government. And it still remains to be seen. So just to give you some examples here, of some of the impacts here. If you're an entity that's a high energy user and your polluter has a liability to purchase a million permits per annum, you'll either need to purchase those at auction, or you can go and buy them from a sink. Under the current legislation, you can go and buy them at auction, or you can purchase them from a sink project. If the estimated price is at $25, you can see there, as I said before, you could buy them on the market at, say, $16. You know, electricity prices are contemplated to go up 20%, and you also need to report on your emissions now and also potentially outlay significant financial sums as early as the next financial year to buy permits. So these are issues that are really live right now. Where do we go through from here? There are a number of committees going on in the Senate at the moment who are looking at this issue, and there are ongoing. The government's still calling for submissions and legislation to be introduced. I just wanted to check. Sorry, there was one more slide which seems to have dropped out here. But just to give you an example, if you take a company like Caltex, based on the analysis done by somebody like Citigroup, Caltex has about a domestic liability from their own operations of what they do on a day-to-day basis of about 3 million tonnes. So they have to buy permits to cover that 3 million tonnes. They also have a liability of about 20 million tonnes for the fuel they sell. So for all of the fuel they sell downstream, they have to buy permits to offset the emissions from that fuel. So what they will do is in selling that fuel, the 20 million tonnes... So the cost of buying 20 million permits for that fuel will be added to the petrol price and passed down the line. Now, if I'm somebody down the line like, let's say, a Linfox or a Qantas, for example, who buys fuel from them, I might say, OK, well, I'll buy the fuel and I'll pay the cost. On the other hand, if I'm a Qantas, I might say, well, actually, I think I can buy Australian permits through my brokers on the market here at 50% of the price of what you want to charge to me for, so I'll take on that liability and I'll pass it through to my customers, as opposed to taking on your higher cost and passing it through. So that's one example of a company that would be liable. Another example would be if you take somebody like Qantas themselves. They have a small liability to buy permits for their domestic operations, their planes on the ground, etc., their emissions from their activities, but they also will have the liability from the fuel, the cost liability from the fuel they use. And come, I think it's the start of next year, for every flight that they fly into Europe, they have to buy a European permit to offset the emissions associated with those flights under the European trading scheme. So there's an example of an Australian company which has a liability which will have a liability under the Australian legislation. It'll also have an international liability flying into the EU, and so it has to manage both a domestic and an international obligation as well. So we're talking about, you know, an impact on Australian companies which is happening now and is relevant and which will happen should the legislation get through. In terms of where we go from here, the government has been very, very adamant that it's going to get this legislation in and through on time. In fact, it's more important to the government to get it through, it seems, at the moment than the actual form it ultimately takes. So it seems there may be some room for compromise. But the government's view is that we came to the election on work choices, we came to the election on climate change, and we're determined to get the legislation through. And while it will easily go through the House of Reps, getting it through the Senate will be the challenge. You know, it's unclear whether the Greens and the other senators will compromise, although there's some movement now that they will. It's also unclear what the opposition's view is, although as of last week, the leadership of the opposition, Malcolm Turnbull, still seems to support emissions trading, and they did come into the election supporting emissions trading, yet they think there should be full compensation to emissions trading exposed industries, and they think the scheme should be delayed a year. So, and there are others in the party and the Nationals who don't support it. So it'll be an interesting... The challenge the government faces in the Senate is not simply one of having parties support it or not support it or wanting amendments, but actually working out what those parties actually stand for on the scheme. At the moment, it is actually quite difficult to ascertain that. So I think we'll find out. But I'm fairly adamant that the government's going to push this extremely hard and is fairly confident of getting it through in some form. And the other thing that we have is we continue to have significant industry lobbying on the scheme. And that is also having an impact. And the scheme itself, when you look at the difference between the green paper and the white paper, has been significantly shaped by what industry wants. And trying to address the concerns of industry. It's also important, as I said at the outset, this scheme brings us in line with what already exists in the EU, and interestingly, it also brings us in line with the US cap and trade proposal. So two senators in the US, Waxman and Markey, put forward a proposal about a month ago now, maybe three weeks ago, for a comprehensive cap and trade scheme in the US. And what's also interesting is that in the US, within the Senate, they have a Senate Committee on Energy and Environment. And that committee is led by four US senators from very different political backgrounds and very different constituencies. And they wrote a letter to the US President a few weeks ago, basically saying that the energy and environment are the two... Sorry, energy and climate change are two of the key issues which we... as a government, have to address and have to address urgently. We call on the administration to deal with this very quickly and to support some of the legislative reforms that are going through. Now, my colleagues in our Washington office say that in 30 years, they have never, ever seen that committee come to a single view on an issue. So in many ways, you know, as we sit here looking at the Australian position, the US are moving in some ways even more quickly. They're calling many international negotiations prior to the meeting at the end of the year in Copenhagen to sort of come to some sort of proposal. And the real focus for the US is getting a sort of a US-China agreement with the view if you get that agreement on climate change, everybody else will fall behind it. So you cannot view what's going on in Australia in isolation from that, particularly as in the longer term our scheme is supposed to link into these global schemes. And particularly as, you know, when you're buying permits and managing your domestic liability, you need to have an eye on what the international carbon price is doing.
Time up.
Okay, so just finally, I was just asked some comments on the financial crisis. What we've seen is that the financial crisis is having an impact on people investing in the space, but at the same time, and there's a lot of concern over the cost of compliance, but at the same time, climate change is a multi-decade issue which won't go away. All the legislation that's being put in place is legislation that's designed to be in place for 20, 30, 40 years, so it's long-term legislation. What the focus on this particular Australian context is that the lobbying effort, because of the financial crisis, has been to delay the scheme for potentially a year or to get more compensation. So the regulation in force, though, is going to need to be complied with regardless of the financial situation. The government's view is we just have to press on. So just in conclusion then, I think the points to make is that we do have this entire new legislative regime with a national regulator enforcement that's being proposed. The reporting legislation is already in place. The first period ends in July 2009, and a lot of companies have said to us, well, we'll get the reporting, you know, pretty right. Near enough's good enough. You know, if we get 50%, 70% right, the legislation requires a 95% accuracy in effect. So that sort of view that near enough is good enough isn't going to work from a regulator's point of view. You also need to understand that this is really, as I said, very much at the outset, this is all about financial costs, financial implications and financial liabilities. And people need to decide whether or not, as a business, it's purely a compliance issue, or whether or not you go a step beyond that and you actually engage in the market and do so in a way that minimises the economic impact on your business or on your clients' businesses as a result of the scheme. And finally, just because we're in a financial crisis isn't stopping the regulatory juggernaut in the EU, in Australia or in the US. So this is a long-term regulatory play which is going forward. Thank you.